Hey, tennis fans, you are listening to Matchpoint Canada, the official podcast of Tennis Canada. We're also members of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. I'm Ben Lewis, joined alongside Mike McIntyre, our sunshine double in the books, Mike, and we have a fantastic guest joining us this week to wrap it all up and look ahead to the clay court season.
Yeah, we're happy to have on this week a popular Tennis Channel broadcaster and analyst. He runs his Monday Match Analysis podcast every week, which I just enjoyed this afternoon. Does work for the U.S. Open and the Challenger Circuit and plenty more. Gil Gross, thank you so much for joining us once again on Matchpoint Canada.
Mike, Ben, thanks so much for the invite. Great to be on. I'm a big fan of what you guys do here.
Thank you so much. Gil, I think a perfect place to start is looking back at the Miami Open and just another incredible tournament, incredible performance, and a couple of weeks from Jannik Sinner, who lost just one set en route to his second career Masters 1000, three titles on the season, 22-1 record, now a major champion. What do you think maybe has allowed Jannik to separate himself from the rest of the pack right now as clearly the most dominant player in men's tennis this season?
People have been asking me for the last 6 months, how do you beat him? Because everybody loves that question. Whenever somebody starts dominating, it's okay, what is everybody going to do? Or what can they do? And I keep saying, I don't know. And that's been the question, I guess, with Novak Djokovic, it would get the same answer. It'd be like, I don't know. Like, what's the type of player who beats Novak Djokovic? What's the tactic or the plan that is optimal against Djokovic? It's really hard to answer that question. And for Sinner, it's become the same thing because he's clogged up all of the holes that he used to have, which frankly was a pretty long list. Like if you asked me 2 years ago or 3 years ago, what does Jannik Sinner need to get better at to become a top player? I would have told you he probably needs to get stronger in the legs. His endurance needs to get better. His durability needs to improve. He needs more variety when it comes to drop shots and volleys and short angles. Like it's all just power through the baseline. And then obviously the serve has been very well documented because there is the major technical change. So, I think he's gotten more consistent. I think he changes direction more. And I don't know what he's not good at this point. And that's why he's winning so much.
Gil, I really enjoyed your Monday Match Analysis this week, sort of recapping things. I was on a family vacation this weekend, so you kind of filled in a lot of the holes of what I missed and explained it with so much, you know, technical expertise too, which was cool. You mentioned that for Sinner, what's helped him avoid a first slam hangover is that he's been impressively unfazed and unsatisfied. And I liked how you kind of combined those two. Could you elaborate a little bit for our listeners, the unsatisfied part? And I also wanted to ask you, who would you put into the category of players that maybe were too satisfied after winning their first slam, I guess?
Sure. I'm going to give you an example of a player who didn't win a slam, but made a huge run and got a little too satisfied. What I mean by that, these people work for a really long time to reach certain goals. And oftentimes, once that mountain is climbed or summited, there is a bit of a hangover or an energy dump, a motivation dump. Like it's just hard to complete your goal and then wake up, maybe not the next morning, but the morning after that, and go back to grinding. Like, all right, back to work. And we're gonna have the same intensity and the same vigor and the same focus with everything we do. That's hard once you reach your goal. So I guess for Sinner, what's just been really impressive is it doesn't seem like the one slam has had that effect because it feels like he wants so much more. And that's just, you know, everybody says they want more, but if you're like a Dominic Thiem, let's say, and it's a little bit different, don't get me wrong, because he's 20, I think he was either 27 or 28 years old.
And then he had the injuries too, which was not out of his control.
Sure. But even before the wrist injury, he wins that US Open and says, I'm struggling with the motivation. The fire isn't burning as bright. And for him, he's been on tour a decade and the primary goal has been to win the slam. And he does it. And then it has that effect. I think, I think Murray, after winning Wimbledon, little bit of a blip, right? Usually it's temporary. Since I'm on Matchpoint Canada, how about Denis Shapovalov when he made the Wimbledon semifinal? He admitted that he got a little bit comfortable, or that he struggled to kind of move past that. And I should really go back and look at exactly what he said, because it was a long time ago now and it's a little fuzzy, but essentially saying that result was so satisfying, it kind of affected me for the rest of the year. Sinner is unsatisfied. It's a good trait to have.
Absolutely. And I appreciate the Canadian example that you provided us with there. Very nicely done. Speaking of, just surprises and, you know, from Chapeau back then, maybe it was a little bit sooner than we expected, but what would be the surprise of the sunshine double for you? Maybe outside of Danielle Collins, because I think that is maybe the obvious answer. And I know Ben's going to ask you a question about her specifically in a moment, but you know, on the men's side, we get Alcaraz and Sinner, which is not very surprising. Women's side, Swiatek, again, not surprising. And then Collins comes along, and what a great story that is. But otherwise, maybe an earlier round or mid-tournament kind of surprise, or just an overall surprise from who didn't maybe make it too far in those two events for you?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is honestly Medvedev making the Indian Wells final again, because in theory, and I know that might be a surprising answer because I'm talking about a top four player, but this should be his worst hard court, theoretically. It's the slowest. It is the toughest on flat hitters. And Medvedev, you know, before running up against Alcaraz, that was a phenomenal run in terms of the players he played and how he beat him. He you know, going through Korda, Dimitrov, Runa, Tommy Paul. I think that's an unbelievable run. And I did not expect Medvedev to be back into an Indian Wells final, just given the surface. Miami on the men's side was so chalky that it's hard for me to even really think of anything, in that respect. But maybe Indian Wells, I'm slipping my mind right now. But well, Daniil was the player who came to mind.
I was thinking of Fabian Marojan, actually, yeah, as well, who had sort of a stunning run. He takes out Holger Rune 6-1, 6-1, and just this incredible streak. I mean, he's shown what he's capable of last year with that upset of Alcaraz, but more strides over the sunshine double. Of course, we have to talk about Danielle Collins. I mean, she's been candid probably more than a number of times about this being the final year of her career. She addressed that question again during her run in Miami. She deals with a disease called endometriosis. And here she is. I mean, she's playing really arguably the best tennis of her life. I know she's a former Australian Open finalist, but the gauntlet that she was able to run through in Miami, what impressed you maybe the most about what she did on the court these past 2 weeks?
I mean, it was the score lines are what impressed me the most. None of these matches were contests until Rybakina. She has always been capable of a pretty stratospheric level when everything is right. And, you know, we've seen her go, you know, to the last weekend at the Australian Open, for example. It doesn't happen all that often or all that consistently, but I think from a health standpoint, a play style standpoint, and also the way her makeup is, like mentally, I think she isn't very good. Like, she doesn't want to be on the tour every week. I don't think she likes it that much. And I think the health stuff comes into play, but also I think that's part of it, that she doesn't love the traveling circus, so to speak. So I think that's made that's created a thing where she's a player who kind of catches fire every once in a while, and is usually, you know, a very, very good player, but not a player who can win or contend for every Masters 1000 throughout the year, or, you know, all four slams throughout the year. So I was just really happy for her, because if it was going to happen at one place other than, I don't know, maybe the US Open, this was the perfect place. She's a Floridian. It's a Masters 1000. She, you know, she said in January, it's going to be her last year, as you alluded to, Ben. And I just thought that you know, so, or I think that so often in this sport, which is really cruel and usually doesn't play out how maybe we all want it to play out sometimes, this was a fairy tale story. We usually don't get that. It gets usually ugly in the end. The best recent example is Federer. Nobody would have designed the way Federer went out for it to happen the way it happened. Nobody would have wanted that. It's just a cruel game. So I like that. I like that Collins actually had that kind of storybook moment in what will likely be her final year, which I do think she will. You know, I saw that some people were like, how is she going to leave when she's playing this well? Mm-hmm. The problem with that was this. She was never retiring because the results weren't there. Like, that was never the thing. So for the results to, you know, for her to have a result like this and be like, well, never mind, I'm not going to retire because I'm getting results, that wouldn't make much sense because the decision wasn't about results in the first place. So I'm pretty certain that she's going to stick by what she said at the start of the year. Now, maybe she, you know, because she's only 30, maybe she will be off the tour for 2 years and decide to come back or something like that. I wouldn't rule that out. But I do think at least for the time being, she is going to at least take some time.
Yeah, no, very, very well said. You discussed Novak Djokovic just a little bit earlier. And, you know, just Sunday, he became the oldest number one in ATP rankings history, 419 weeks now. And meanwhile, I mean, I think the biggest story here is a sudden coaching change. He's saying goodbye to Goran Ivanisevic after, you know, over 5 years, 12 Grand Slam titles, just incredible accomplishments with this pairing. Are you surprised he made this move, given it is still pretty early in the season and he really hasn't played that many tournaments in 2024?
I'm a little surprised. I would obviously be less surprised if something didn't seem so off about Novak so far this year. And, you know, it might sound harsh, Australian Open semifinal, a loss at Indian Wells in March, and I never really put much stock into what Djokovic does in March because I don't know that he's a player who can actually keep up the intensity 10 or the fitness 10, 11 months out of the year anymore. I don't think he has any interest in doing that anymore. He's trying to peak for the slams. Still, you know, he has at no point in time this year, other than maybe like sets 3 and 4 against Fritz, looked like the best version of Novak Djokovic. So already there is kind of like a, all right, you know, not ringing the alarm bells yet necessarily, but it has been a strange year. And in that respect, I wasn't stunned, but obviously it's been this incredibly successful partnership. Now, most of the credit always goes to the player, and that's how it should be, and that's how it is. But if we're going to look to Goran and what he can hang his hat on, there has never been a more successful adaptation into, I'm going to say, tennis's old age than what Novak Djokovic has done since turning 30. Like, it's never been done in this sport, what Djokovic has done since turning 30. And Goran was overseeing what was a transformative Novak Djokovic, who is playing less defense and doing less grinding and, you know, comes out with a bigger serve and a more deadly forehand, and he's just playing shorter, more offensive tennis. Ivanisevic is the guy who was at least, I don't want to say he's the guy who made that happen because it's the player. It's always the player. But still, as far as coaching goes, he gets credit for that. The timing is not ideal though, right? It's March, the year just started, and now, you know, we head into the summer, Roland Garros, Wimbledon, Olympics, US Open. It all comes pretty quick. So he has to figure out something that he's happy with and something that works. And he needs to get that where he wants it to be quickly.
Gil, I'm on board with you that, you know, we've seen, you know, there's a lot more we're going to see from Novak Djokovic this year and beyond. It always kind of amuses me when people start doubting a player as great as him, especially with what he did last year, which was not that long ago. But the coaching change that you just discussed with Ben, do you think that he's panicking a little prematurely? Like, we talk about how those in the tennis media are maybe, you know, too much recency bias and putting too much stock into his early season struggles. Do you think he's panicking a little too soon making this switch after only playing a couple of events so far this year?
You know, I'm not sure. The funny thing about this right now is we haven't heard from Goran, and we haven't really heard from Novak other than a social media post. And therefore, you know, we're in a tough position as tennis media because we're trying to have an opinion and we're trying to break down the situation. And we know like absolutely nothing. So that's the tough part. I just wonder, watching kind of their interactions on court recently, if Novak has always felt like even Ivanišević could give him a little bit more in-match on-court coaching. When even Ivanišević started with Novak, it was illegal. It wasn't even a part of the equation. Now it is, and I'm wondering if even, you know, before Djokovic started struggling this year, if perhaps he's wanted more in that area. So that's my only, you know, I don't want to even call it a theory, but something that's somewhat on my radar. And I'm curious to see who Novak picks next and what the player coach interactions look like. That will tell us something. It wouldn't be very like Novak to panic, because, you know, there have been plenty of instances, you know, one or two tournaments here and there where he's not close to his level, especially March and April. Like, there was that year he lost early in Monte Carlo, he lost 6-love in a final to Rublev in Belgrade after that. And people were starting to ring alarm bells. Novak's not right. And then he, you know, he writes the ship and does great in Rome and does well at Roland Garros after that. So it looks like that. I get why people would think that, but I would assume that that's not the case.
And Goran obviously is going to bounce back real quick. I'm sure there's going to be players that are lining up already, getting in touch to employ his services. On the flip side as well, I'm sure there's plenty of people who are making it known to Novak and his camp that they would be interested in coaching him. I wonder, have you given any thought at all to, you know, what kind of coach might work best with Novak or who he might be looking for? You've mentioned maybe someone who in a match is going to give him a little bit more of what he needs in those moments. Is there anyone that comes to mind that might sort of check off some of those boxes for you?
I kind of agree with something Andy Roddick said on TC Live. Novak will probably go to somebody familiar here, just because it's not really the time in his career for experimentation or risk-taking. When you're that age and when you have important tournaments coming up, the clock is ticking, you know, and there's just no time to play around. So I wouldn't be surprised if we saw somebody who has already had association with Novak, like Marian Vida comes back, or Boris Becker comes back.
Excited with Boris Becker. I'm a huge Becker fan, so yeah.
I wouldn't be stunned. You know, they've already had that correspondence. So the key is there. Novak knows what he's getting. And, you know, he's been around the tour a while, so I'm sure there are people who he has relationships and he knows very well who aren't, you know, former Novak coaches, so to speak. But I think whoever it is, it's going to be somebody very familiar to Djokovic and potentially familiar to us as well.
Yeah, and as you said, the tennis season doesn't stop. Already we're making the surface change with clay court events this week, big one in Charleston. What does maybe, I mean, as you said, it's sometimes kind of hard to forecast these things, and it's two hard court events. But if anything, what would maybe the Sunshine Double tell us in a way of forecasting who might look good at the early stages on clay?
Well, Alcaraz was not playing up to his ability because his mind was getting in the way. After Wimbledon, right? So we saw that for 6 months. He was still a great player, but he wasn't his best player because he was in his head. He was lacking decision-making. He was lacking confidence, belief, a sense of calm on the court. Sometimes focus was lacking, like all of this mental stuff, right? But as far as everything he can do is, you know, movement, skills, weapons, like all of that was always there. Indian Wells is going to make him a factor now again, I think, in the fullest capacity. Like Alcaraz, I think ran into a Dimitrov who did some pretty crazy things in that match. Like, that was an amazing performance mm-hmm. on a fast court. But my observation has been, you know, when Carlos has a lot of time on the ball, his forehand becomes the best in the world. And it's not always the case on the quicker surfaces where it can just, everything can be a little bit more rushed. And then Sinner, this version of Jannik, we haven't really seen on clay. I have no doubt that he's going to be, phenomenal. But will the clay, I guess, disrupt the dominance? I don't want to say disrupt the momentum, because he's still going to be really, really good. I have no doubt about that. But is it going to disrupt the dominance? I think that's an interesting question. And then you go to Iga. I saw a great stat the other day that if you add up all the rankings points after clay court season last year, so after Roland Garros to now, so you just take clay out, Iga's still number one in the race.
Wow.
Right? Amazing. So it is. So anybody who says, you know, Iga's ranking is built on clay and that's why she's number one, it's wrong. Mathematically. So, you know, what is the, how strong does the fortress hold for Iga? Because I think there's a lot, look, I think clay could be Coco's best surface. I think there's a decent argument there. And I think Sabalenka, there's a lot to love about her on clay. I think Rybakina is, you know, I think clay does take away from her, but I think the other two, not so much. So that's going to be fascinating. At the top of the women's game,
Simona Halep is the wild card, right?
Potentially, you know, it's always interesting to see for a player who relies that much on physicality. I worry a little bit, and that doesn't mean that there aren't players who rely a lot on physicality who don't have, you know, very fruitful years into the 30s. You know, I mean, those players exist. I mean, heck, I think David Ferrer's best season came when he was 32, as an example. But it's not as straightforward as some of the more powerful players who, you know, can kind of maintain their level through their 30s, because the power just never goes away, like never, ever, right? Serena was never going to start serving slower because she was 35. Like, that was just never going to happen. So Halep is somebody who I think fights an uphill battle in that respect, but she looked pretty good in Miami.
The draw, you know, it always comes down to that for players returning when you don't have the ranking and the seating anymore. Is are the tennis gods going to be kind to you when the draw comes out? My last clay court question for you, Gil, before we let you go, is the clay court has a little extra oomph this year with the Olympic Games happening in Paris in the summertime at Roland Garros as well. So I'm just curious for you, how do the Olympic Games stack up in terms of, you know, where they fit in the overall tennis landscape? And, you know, do you feel that this having it on clay this year, the Olympics, might kind of change in any way who's in contention for a medal? Or do you feel that, you know, these days, the difference between the top players, regardless of surface, is not what it kind of used to be?
Well, I think what you said is true. The difference between the surfaces is not what it used to be. What I'm most interested to see is how it affects the grass season, because it's a really weird thing this year going clay, grass, clay. And, you know, there are talks about certain players, and it could be a lot of reasons. For Novak, it's he wants those Olympics, that Olympic gold, really, really bad. Is there a de-emphasis on grass for a Novak, or for a player who isn't all that good on grass anyway? Might they skip it? Might they be like, I think I have a chance to do great at the Olympics. Like, if you're like Casper Ruud, who over the years hasn't played before Wimbledon at all, like he's literally taken vacation after Roland Garros, I guess you turn up at Wimbledon. Like, I don't imagine anybody or a lot of players really make the decision not to show up at Wimbledon with the tournament that it is. Yes, but also the check that you even get for losing in the first round. But I still think it might change the psychology for some players and the prioritization for some players, because it is that, you know, switching to grass real quick and then straight to the Olympics. So that's what I'm interested, what I'm very interested to see. But I'd say other than that, it's such a big marquee event for Djokovic. The fact that it's every 4 years, just it really heightens the importance. And you basically know that this is Novak's last Olympics, and it's been a big priority for him. So that's the number one storyline coming in. I think, you know, without a doubt, that's what jumps out.
Yeah, 100%. Well said, Gil. And thank you so much for taking the time. It's been great just to watch on the sidelines the way your career has taken off, doing so much more work with the Tennis Channel and your terrific Monday match analysis and YouTube page. We really think you're one of the foremost sort of experts in the game. So it's always a pleasure having you on.
Thank you guys so much. Had fun chatting. Hopefully we do it again soon, and have a great rest of the show.
Yeah,
thanks a lot, Gil. It. Cheers.
Cheers. Yeah.
There he goes, Gil Gross of the Tennis Channel. If you haven't watched it, do check out Monday Match Analysis wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube. I know Mike, you watched his this week. He really breaks it down really nicely.
And in a way that's so like not in your face either. Like, I just enjoy listening to him speak. He's got a great demeanor, a great tone. And it's funny, it's the first time I've spoken to him face to face in this episode today, but I feel like I've chatted with him so many times before, and that's just sort of the approach that he has. So very, very good at what he does.
Yeah, 100%. I will mention that this episode is brought to you by Hotel X. And Mike, you're going to give our word from our sponsor this week.
And I got to tell you, I was just at Hotel X a couple of weeks ago with my family, and we had a wonderful time. And hey, look, if you're looking for the perfect urban getaway for your next family vacation, look no further than Hotel X Toronto. It's the city's premier urban resort with its state-of-the-art fitness facility, 10XTO, 4 indoor tennis courts. There's something for everyone in the family. But that's not all that Hotel X has to offer. With luxurious amenities, from the rooftop pool to the award-winning Guerlain Spa, from the 250-seat cinema to the three-level sky bar, there's so much to see and do all under one roof. Whether you're visiting Toronto for business or pleasure, Hotel X is the perfect choice for families and individuals alike. Book your stay today at Toronto's only urban resort, Hotel X Toronto. Experience the extraordinary. And Ben, I got to tell you, and this is just me speaking here, of course, but experience the extraordinary with my family. We hit up the tennis courts, the pickleball courts, the basketball court. Even though it was winter, we hit up the rooftop pool. That was nice. A nice 85 degrees. And just had a fantastic time. So thank you to Hotel X and 10XTO for taking care of us here at Matchpoint Canada.
Yeah, I love that club. I want to talk a little more women's tennis and a great result from one of our Canadians and a Canadian Kiwi player, Gabby Dabrowski and Erin Routliff, making their first final of 2024 as their successful partnership continues. Of course, the reigning U.S. Open champions. And, you know, I was covering actually their semifinal match for Tennis Canada, and what a comeback it was against the Americans, Asia Muhammad and Alicia Parks. They were down a set, down 4-3 in the second, and just the ability to dig deep, Gabby coming up with some fantastic shots at net when they needed it, Routliff being really solid with the serve, and they completely flipped the momentum of the match and just ran away with that super tiebreak. And in the finals, they're so unbelievably close, losing 11-9 in the super tiebreak. So they were incredibly close from a big WTA 1000, but I think they're going to get a big boost of confidence from this result.
Yeah, look, when you lose 11-9 in a tiebreak to a duo like Bethany Mattek-Sands and Sofia Kenin, there's absolutely no shame in that. And what a partnership these two have been. Just super impressive since they joined forces. When you think about it, last summer, it was halfway through the season and both kind of admitted, hey, it's not clicking with our usual partners. What are we going to do here? They joined forces, and in their fourth tournament together, they win a Grand Slam. So that's pretty fantastic stuff. They somehow magically in half a season are able to accumulate enough points to qualify for the WTA finals, where they make the semis. And then they start this year, fantastic form, making the semis at the Australian Open, the semis in Dubai, and now the finals in Miami as well. So what a superb partnership. And, you know, today, as we record this, April 1st is Gabby Dabrowski's birthday, turning 32 years old. And 32 years for a doubles player is nothing. I think there's so much that her and Erin still have to accomplish. And to me, it's I don't want to say it's a lock. Of course, there's still a lot of tennis to be played, but they, to me, are going to be back at the WTA finals again this year, and super excited to see what they can continue to accomplish together. It's been just a match in heaven, really, when you think about it.
Yeah, 100%. And as you said, I mean, making semifinals kind of consistently and here a final, they're putting themselves in the business end of tournaments each and every week, it seems. So I'm sure a title is just around the corner. We touched on, you know, Gil touched on Iga Świątek and her incredible dominance with ranking points and success. This was a surprise. I mean, she was definitely my pick to win my own Miami on the women's side. Ekaterina Alexandrova taking her out in straight sets. And it wasn't Iga's best performance by any means, but this was a kind of a masterclass from Ekaterina Alexandrova on her side, hitting hard and flat and just taking time and space away. Just maybe showing Iga on a certain day, if you run into a red hot opponent like that, I think anybody can be vulnerable.
I mean, it shows you that nobody is unbeatable. And even though Świątek at times gives off this aura of invincibility, you know, in the way that she won Indian Wells, handing out bagels or breadsticks in every one of those wins, she's captured the Sunshine Double before, has she not? Am I wrong on that one?
No, maybe she did. When she
had 2022, that, right?
38 match winning streak. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Like, she went through that period where it looked like she might never lose a tennis match again, but this is just a good reminder, just in the same way that Danielle Collins' victory is a reminder, especially I would say on the women's tour, where there's so much depth and so many strong players, not just within the top 10 that can capture tournaments. And, you know, Gil alluded to this, that for Collins at times, boy, she can look like a top 10er, no doubt. Certainly in the early parts of the season, she seems to always excel in Australia. And here we are having this huge result for her. And I just think it's so incredible for her to experience this, regardless of what the future holds for her after this season. Maybe she follows in the footsteps of a Serena Williams, Caroline Wozniacki, or many, many other women who have come back after giving birth and becoming parents and still had success. For her, a little bit more challenging because of the health issues that she's had. You know, and she really opened up in press when she was asked ahead of the finals, does this change how you're thinking about retirement? And, you know, she didn't make the person with the question feel bad, but she kind of did say, like, look, this is very different for women. And especially given, you know, that her health situation really does impact her ability to become pregnant. And clearly she wants to have a family, and we wish her the best with that. You know, it's tough on female athletes when they get to this stage. You know, for men, look at Roger Federer. He had four kids and he played right on through it. It's obviously different for obvious reasons for women. And I hope for the best for her that she can, if this is what she wants, have a family. And if this is indeed her last season on tour, then my goodness, she's going out with a bang and playing the best tennis that we've seen for her, which is fantastic.
Yeah, that's well said. I touched a little bit on Leila Annie Fernandez on last week's episode. She looked good against Jessica Pegula. She had a chance. She was up 5-3 in that opening set. Pegula turning things around and taking it in straights in a competitive two-set match. And Leila will be playing in Charleston, which I'm looking forward to. Maria Sakkari had a very nice tournament. Finals the previous event at Indian Wells and making quarters here in Miami. I'll touch on, because we didn't really touch on Grigor Dimitrov. You mentioned 32-year-olds. I love kind of seeing, you know, women and men in their 30s, as someone who's 35 now, make a special run. And
how do you think I feel in my 40s, Ben?
I know what you mean. So Rohan Bopanna in Australia must have been special for you.
Thanks. Thanks. That's a bit of a dig, but I'll take it. Yeah, fair enough.
I promise it wasn't a dig. So Grigor, I think, just especially the past like 6 to 12 months, playing some of the best tennis of his career. I mean, a masterclass beating Carlos Alcaraz in straight sets. It was almost perfection. And look, Jannik Sinner was just way too strong in that final. But Grigor is back in the top 10. We had that conversation of no one-handed backhands in the top 10 with Christopher Clary the other month. And Grigor has changed the narrative.
Yeah, and I love to see the fact that there's a one-hand backhand back there. And I also love to see the fact that Dimitrov is having this, you know, back end of his career success. And he's of that era of players that got kind of screwed by the big three or the big four. And what are you going to do, right? So the fact that he's having this success right now, you know, Gil mentioned in his podcast this week that, you know, he didn't think the baby Fed tagline really fit earlier in his career, but that maybe right now he's playing in a way that's more Federer-like later in his career. And so, you know, that's just a great story and perseverance, never give up. And, you know, let's see what he can do with the rest of this season. But encouraging for the older guys, for sure. And, you know, Raonic, Miloš Raonic, also of that generation, too. Yep. And we hope for the best for him. He's had some health struggles, obviously, this year. And I just found out from his camp that he will not be playing the clay court swing. And he's going to instead look ahead to grass, which is his bread and butter, and a place I think he can still have an impact. So these guys in that 30 plus range, definitely going to want to show the young guys like Alcaraz and Sinner that they've still got a thing or two to say.
Yeah, no, that's very sensible, I think, for Milos. Quick wrap up here. Your top three clay court players, men's and women's, as we head into the season. This is our power rankings. I can go first if you want, Mike.
Yeah, go ahead. Go for it.
Okay, so my top three as it stands on the women's side, Iga Świątek, Arina Sabalenka, and Elena Rybakina. Maybe no surprises there. Coco, I had just at fourth, so right on the precipice, but...
Okay, so you and me are so boring and predictable because that's exactly how I have mine too. You can't not have Iga number one, Sabalenka, yes, who won Madrid and made the French Open semis last year, Rybakina won Rome, and Goff, we all know, has played well at Roland Garros before too. So, you know, they've shown they can do it on multiple surfaces. On my men's side, I'll go first here, okay? You see if you got something different. I got Djokovic number one because he's still the reigning champ there. Nadal number two, even though there's a question mark. But if he plays it, my God, how can you vote against him? And Alcaraz number three.
Okay. I have Alcaraz one just because of Djokovic's struggles. Djokovic is two. And Jannik Sinner number three. We'll leave it at that. I do have Rafa in my top 10, I promise.
We'll discuss further next week for sure.
Exactly. That and much more next week on our next episode of Matchpoint Canada. Guys, thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next time.